273 degrees Kelvin, background temperature of space. That certainly is a national shrine, a national resource. I think you're saying that the 60-foot dish, which is nearby, also is considered a resource. I know that Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU, was making a lot of use of that 60-foot dish. But what made the 60-foot dish a resource? Some of the early satellite repeater work? Over to you, Gordon.
Yeah, certainly. I don't know if the dish is if the 60-foot dish is part of that protected national, what do you call it? The national monument, the designation, national historic site or something. But I know the cornucopia dish is it was built for Project Echo. Let's start there. Let's back up. There's some great stories there. So if you guys remember, you remember see the red and white towers with these cornucopia dishes with a grayish white radome on the face. And the cornucopia dishes were generally red. That's pretty much how the paint job was on the old square towers that AT&T is famous for. And a lot of those towers still exist for one thing or another, but the dishes have been removed. The wave guide came up from the bottom, blah, 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 blah. They used those same dishes when they were asked to go see what they could do to support Project Echo. So they put one of those things on its side and basically allowed you to 180-degree, what do you call it, rotation or elevation. And then they put it on a circular track along with the goodies at the other end, if you will, at the bottom, or in this case the end of the feed horn, the feed point where the waveguide came in. They had a little building structure that would roll around in circles along with the antenna. And what Penzias's problem was, let me drop it. In case you haven't figured out, I've switched radios here. I'm trying to see if this makes sense to use this radio. So if after the transmission you don't like it, tell me to go back to the other radio. But I want to give AHT a chance to cool down. So anyway, what was happening with Penzias was that he was having a terrible time getting what he called stray noise to come out of the system. And he thought it was, literally bird crap, that was causing this problem. He was going out there and dutifully cleaning by hand himself of, bird droppings from the dish, bat droppings, every possible bit of guano you could ever imagine, pollen, anything that would be in there. They were, vacuuming it out, blowing it out, whatever they had to do, getting out there, scrubbing it, and to get the noise down, and yet still they had this noise. And finally they realized where they were pointing the antenna when this was happening, and that's when they realized it was pointed out to that wonderful spot in the solar system that is where that noise source is, and boom, that's when they realized that they had come up with the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, you're saying the wonderful spot in the universe. It's the other way around. It's the whole darn universe, except for a couple of spots, that has this background radiation of 2.73 degrees Kelvin. And those guys were sticklers. They were real, what's the word for it? Obsessive compulsive personality, OCPD types. Because only a guy with a cryogenically cooled receiver would be able to measure an amount of noise of less than 3 degrees above absolute zero and say, hey, something's wrong. Only an OCPD would discover that with a cryo receiver. By the way, you keep calling it a cornucopia antenna. I think it officially might be called a hog horn, because I think Mr. Hogg invented it. You go to the right Bell Lab literature, you will see the azimuth and elevation pattern of that hog horn, and it's just out of sight. It's the only antenna you've ever seen in the world where essentially all the side lobes are 30 and 40 dB down, front to back ratio 50 dB. That's got an antenna pattern that you will, that you can talk about theoretically. No other antenna can come close. Over to you, Gordon, KQRW.
Well, you're right. There, well, let me see here. Actually, I'm looking up the Homedel horn antenna. If you just Google Homedel horn antenna, you'll see it. It's still there. You can still look at it. But it's now the property of Alcatel-Lucent. And the way they stow it with the aperture face down, so that way it doesn't collect water and other garbage.
Yeah, I've seen that website, and there's about four websites about it. There's a monument alongside of it with a nice plaque describing what point in history it played, roughly 1968, I think it was, when that event occurred. And I think it was considered one of the major radio events of the 20th century. I'm still amazed, though, that the 60-foot dish is being maintained. I don't know if it had done anything quite as impressive. Maybe Rachel knows. Over to you, Rachel, KQRIW.
KQRIW, W2TPT, this is AJ4WD. No, I don't. And I am now at my QTH, so I'm going to sign 7-3. But very interesting dissertation and conversation here. I thank you for allowing me to stick my my head in. This is AJ4WD. I'll be clear after your final.
One other crazy question, Gordon. You talked about one of the Bell Lab sites in Middletown. I should know better. My son lives in Middletown, New York. I'm guessing there's a Middletown, New Jersey. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's right next to Homedel. Yeah, and good night, Rachel. Let's put this in perspective too. I wanted to, kind of complement your question or your point. First of all, thank you for the correction on the context. I was stating it in reverse mode. That was ridiculous. So thank you for that. Number two point was the OCD level required to go digging, looking for noise, as close to a noiseless environment as possible and try to discern its source. I'm just going to say this. I spend an awful lot of time looking for and rooting out what I'll call fault signatures in RF-based systems or transmission line systems, VDSL, ADSL, cellular systems of one form or another, point-to-point microwave, etc. To this day, looking at all the protocol stacks that go with them that are on top, not just the physical layer, but also the IP stack and even the application layers that are on top of that. Looking across those things to see, if there are signs of discord and unhappiness that would otherwise go undetected. So that level of what I'll call thorough investigation, even though it's harder to do today because of business pressures, there's a steady cadre of folks across all age groups, not just those of us who are 50 plus, who are pursuing these what I'll call these signatures of these anomalous signatures, and trying to understand what their business impact is, where I mean, we're not discovering the Big Bang, but we're still using that same kind of methodology or that same, should we say, mindset and ruthless pursuit of what's operative and what's, you know, just, if you will, pardon the use of the word, but noise, you know, in affecting the way the services, the components, the and the customers are all, you know, experiencing real life. It's a lot of fun. That's what I get to do for
repeater. Repeater. Timeout. Clear.
I timed out just as it burped. Sorry.
Good timing. I'm going to guess the machine times out in something like 1.5 minutes. I haven't been timing it. The other guy who was looking for a mysterious source of noise, and I think he was again a Bell Lab engineer, is Carl Jansky, 1932. And that particular Sturber curtain-like antenna with rotational capability is now sitting in front of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia. That and the Grote Reber 31-foot diameter dish. So these guys with these rotatable significant antennas on their individual frequency regions, think about that now. Jansky with his rotatable curtain, Reber with his homebrew 31-foot parabolic dish, and then the Homedel Hughorn laying on its side. Each one of these guys are looking for noisy signals. By the way, crazy little statement. Have you ever heard of what kind of noise, a noise, an oyster? Over to you, Gordon, KTRIW.
W2TTT. No, I've never heard that. But you're right, Jansky did work on the Sturber curtain and had them rotatable, which to me is just an amazing concept. But anyway, let's see, what there was something I wanted to tap into when you said, I know what I wanted to ask. I wanted to ask you a question. You remember Carl, W2AZL, and Bob Serrato, W2NCF, and I'm trying to remember who the third one of their little rat pack was. But I can tell you a story about an amplifier that they all built. That I had one of them. I'm trying to remember who the third guy was. But anyway, but you know these characters, and of course you know Carl's W2AZL receive converter with the new Vistors, right? The 417s.
Sure do. That AZL converter, AZL preamplifier, 416s, 417s, in its day on 2 meters, and then on 432. That was not only the state of the art, that was the edge of the art. And I think those guys used to get all together for lunch 1 or 2 days per week. I think it was on a Wednesday. And W2TTM, I think it was Ed, was one of the guys who used to join that group. Were you also part of that assemblage at one time? Gordon, go ahead.
Alas, I am too young. Okay. So you just filled in who the third guy was because it was Ed. Now I have a call sign. I've always wondered who that was, and it's kind of ironic. He's W2TTM. Boy, that's even more exciting. That adds some really color to the whole story. So the three of them get it in their head one day that they really want to have a kilowatt amplifier that would be killer. And they just weren't happy with the idea of a 4CX300 or a 4CX250. But they, you know, that was back in the days where, you remember, a lot of guys were building the Plumber's Delight, you know, copper tubing that was silver plated, with the tuned lines that were coming, that were put on the anodes of the 4CX250 and the 4CX300. You know the design, right?
Yes, I think I do. I think it was a push-pull piece of plumbing. with large pieces of pipe. But go ahead.
This is before your design came up, which has its own interesting story in my world, but I think I've told you before, but you got me in trouble with your 432 amplifier because I had that copy of, I think, QST shoved inside my math textbook, and my sophomore math teacher was less than pleased.
Oh, so I got you in trouble. Oh, well. So you were reading about the parallel kilowatt amplifier or the 12-foot dish, and you were doing this during school time. Is that the problem?
I mean, you know, if I'm going to, you know, my view toward your parabola was I was going to take geometry. I wanted to make it real. My teacher was, my high school teacher was, math teacher was none too impressed.
But that parabolic shape, and as you know, when you take the 18 spokes, was it 12 spokes or 18 spokes? I think it's 18 spokes of that parabolic dish, and you bend them with a piece of 130-pound Dacron fishing string on the tips of all those spokes, and you draw them toward the focal point. You're kind of cantilever loading each of the spokes. You want the curve to be a perfect parabolic shape, and you end up with a certain... Let me let it drop. You end up with a certain error curve where it's not parabolic, and you have to pre-bend the aluminum spokes so that with the opposite error curve, so that when you bend them in this manner, they come out with a perfect parabolic shape. There's lots of good mathematics there. He should appreciate that. And I made that discovery by the 12-foot dish. I was using it at 2.3 gigs to listen to the Apollo astronauts. I was going to use it to listen to Apollo 15. I needed an antenna range 300 feet long to test it, an anechoic chamber. Nobody had a chamber that big at that time. So I aimed it at the sun. I discovered that there was extra, not even a side lobe. The main lobe had two lobes to it because of this error term. And that's how I discovered, by making a template and holding it against, I made a 12-foot long template out of black tar paper and held it up against the dish and said, oh, look at that. Look at the light under the curve in certain areas. That's how I discovered the error. So there's a lot of good mathematics there. Only some of that information appeared in the article. So your math teacher should have appreciated that, eh? And I don't think he had the right altitude. Over to you, Gordon, KTRLIW.
Well, here's the irony, Dick. My two worst subjects in high school, in aggregate, were math and science, in that order. It sounds almost, incredible, but that was fact. I mean, I was conceptually interested in what I'll call memory challenged or contextually challenged in the introduction. So, and I don't want to belabor this too much now, but the bottom line is that if they had started with a parabola and then taught you everything there was about the little equations related to the parabola and started messing with characteristics, like you're saying, is it deforming it or moving, moving the focal point in and out, and therefore having to change the shape of the parabola, and they did it using a real system, whether it was optical, acoustic, RF, it wouldn't matter. It would have been just lovely. Unfortunately, that's not how the test subject is taught. I mean, mathematics is taught by, here, memorize this crap, do these 80 problems, and oh, by the way, the word problems are at the bottom. Well, when in point of fact, they should introduce the topic with the word problems, teach you the mechanics, and then let you use either a combination of fewer than 80, just mechanical problems in combination with additional word problems that provide rich texture and context for you to appreciate what is being communicated in the mathematical principles.
And just like you, we are both convinced that the way we teach math and science in our schools, the so-called traditional way, we've always done it this way, why should we change? I don't think they could make it more boring if they tried. And if they just put forth the tiniest bit of effort to relate it to the real world, they could make it a fascinating subject. Have you ever seen the book by, why can't I think of the guy's author's name all of a sudden? It's called Thinking Physics, Epstein. Mr. Epstein wrote a book called Thinking Physics, which now is in its third edition and 29th printing. That is a book. Have you ever seen that particular book, Gordon? Go ahead.
No, but I'm in the process of writing myself a note to go look it up tomorrow, and possibly, well, part of the reason for writing myself an email on it is so that once I do find the rest of the material, I can socialize it with some of my colleagues by Epstein. Thank you very much. But yeah, I mean, well, you and I have beaten this subject to death more than once, but you know, the bottom line is, you know, there's a bit of curiosity, the whole thing. I was bored by traditional literature, but I was a passionate reader. I loved reading biography. I didn't understand a whole lot of point of novels. I actually would rather read about real people. That was kind of the way I was. It was more concrete. My best language in high school was French. My second best was social studies, or whatever they called it, history, whatever. My next best was theology. I went to a Catholic high school. My next best was English. By the way, my second best subject actually was not social studies. I thought about it 1 second. My second best subject was military science, because I had junior ROTC. That was an academic subject, which included all sorts of things, which was a great subject, a great, great course, leadership and principles of leadership and land navigation, three-dimensional navigation, all sorts of goodies. Anyway, enough of that. And my worst subject was math. Science was next to math. But, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, I'm 54 years old. Do I really care now? but I think the more important thing to think about is, you know, that if you grasp the principles, if you grasp the principles, the analytical principles, we can always get a trained monkey to push through the arithmetic.
Very true. Yeah, this book called Thinking Physics is the title of the book. It's a soft cover. It's a paperback. Sells for about $32. I guess the third edition probably has 300 pages, 200 pages by Epstein. You can easily get that by Google, Amazon and all these others. Many good bookstores will have it. Don't even question. Buy it, open it up, and you'll say, wow. Why in the world don't they teach physics this way? Each page has got a stick figure illustration and ask you multiple choice questions. And boy, does that teach a whole lot of physics in a hurry, in a way that you'll retain it, in a way that's exciting. There's a huge amount of improvement that can be done in the way we teach math and physics. Lots and lots of students hate math, hate physics. Can't hate those subjects. You probably heard me say, it's like saying I hate oxygen. You can hate the way you were introduced to the subject. You can hate the way you were taught the subject. You could acquire the opinion of the teacher who was forced to teach that subject and hated that he was forced to teach it, and therefore he transferred that hate onto you. But you can't hate that subject. If you realize what those subjects do, you can't hate the subject. It's like hating water and hating oxygen. Over to you, Gordon, KQRIW.
author really Lewis Carroll Epstein?
Give that man a cigar. He found it.
Oh my lord! I mean, you know, he couldn't come up with a better name.
Okay, what do you read into that name? Tell me.
Lewis Carroll, help me out here. Winnie the Pooh?
Are you talking about Alice in Wonderland? That Lewis Carroll?
Yes. I'm sorry. Yes, thank you.
Oh, yeah. Good name. I think he is a professor in the University of New Orleans, Alabama, one of those places. But the guy's a genius. Now, slightly different subject. What do you know of the relationship between Dr. Reed Fisher, W2CQH, and cell phones? What do you know about their relationship?
Let's see, pre-Motorola, was he on the team that originally conceived of the cellular network?
You got it. Mr. Martin Cooper is officially listed as the inventor of the cell phone, a Motorola employee, who, yes, he did apparently make the first cell phone call on the network that he set up in New York City. He set up a cell site, has this great big chunk of a walkie-talkie, World War II walkie-talkie-like thing against his head. It looks like 5 pounds of hardware. You simply Google the word Martin Cooper and Wikipedia, you'll see his picture, and he is officially listed as the inventor of the cell phone. Wow. What an injustice that is. I was having these 4 times a week, 3 times a week, 432 meg conversations with Dr. Reed Fisher back in 1968, and he started describing to me this concept of a cellular telephone system, wireless telephone system. You can't completely say that he's the inventor, but I think he is a hell of a lot more inventor than any other human being on planet Earth, and he gets no credit for it. Huge injustice there by my standards. Over to you, Gordon, KQRIW.
I'm trying to remember. I have to go back. But I think Reed Fisher was a Bell Labs fellow, and in that context, I believe one of the things that was in the citation, I remember reading one day abstracted citations for why people were Bell Labs fellows, and it was, you know, this 100+ of them or whatever it was at the time, you know, pre-1983. I remember going through, a short, maybe 4 or 5 sentences on each person as to what it was that they had, you know, what were the hallmarks of their career that contributed to their being Bell Labs fellows, and I seem to remember he was on that list.
Absolutely. Yeah, Bell Labs fellow. I think he retired 1990-ish, living in Georgia or Florida right now. I've emailed him a year or two ago discussing this exact subject, and he's not bitter, but I think he should be. He's really getting no credit for an awful lot of work. I was in front of him face to face when he and I were both buying a Vidicon camera from this used equipment place in Brooklyn, roughly 1970, and he had already visited that Radio Row, as I call it, in Japan. You know the name of the place, I don't. He had already been negotiating with them to manufacture the hardware. He knew that massive hardware at minimum prices was going to be manufactured to carry out this concept of cellular telephone network. And so he was already setting up the manufacturers. Make a rough guess, Gordon. How many cell phones are in use in the United States right now? Over to you, Gordon, KQRIW.
I had that number in my head. about a year ago, and I know it's already gone, but I believe right now worldwide there are in excess of 3 billion cell phones for a population that's heading towards 7 billion people. And the rate of population is slower than that of the rate of cell phone growth. There are a lot of things that have cell phones now that are over and above people. My household has N plus one cell phones. We have 5 of us in our household, but we have 6 cell phones because I have a data-only cell phone as the 6th one. And every one of the other phones has its own data account, you know, a data, you know, plan as part of the you know, in addition to their voice plan. So, go figure. I don't know what the U.S. number is off the top of my head right now, and I don't want to speculate. There's a lot of, also there's a lot of finagling as to how that number is derived, but that's a whole nother discussion. My company makes a habit of making things pretty straight as to what we think the number is and how we calculate it. We tell people how we calculate it, and other companies kind of make up their own rules as to what they're counting as a cell phone or a cell phone account or as a, an addressable unit on the mobility network infrastructure.
So in the Gordon household, the cell phone to population ratio is 6 to 5. You are right on the money. There's something like 340 million cell phones in use in the United States by one assessment. More than the population of every man, woman, and child, and another 10% or so above that, 10 or 15%. There are countries in the world, a couple of European countries and one of the, I think Saudi Arabia or one of those countries, where the number of cell phones is almost twice the population of every man, woman, and child. This idea of combining a wireless network with a computer and having these portable communication things, I think that could be a good idea. I think it's going to catch on now, Gordon. What do you think?
I'll let you know. Give it some time. Hey, Dick, let me give you a couple of things before I forget. Number one, back in the 70s, when I was in high school, and after that, you know, started to work and go to school, college, and into the 80s, yeah, I carried around a handy talkie. And, you know, when I could get rid of having a Motorola handy talkie, you know, having something like an ICOM 2AT or something like that, or one of the more advanced ones, that was kind of nifty and neat. It was especially nice not to carry around a Motorola, because every time I carried a Motorola, I had to whip out my ham license and explain that to the cop. And, you know, I didn't know ham radio operators had Motorola handy talkies. Did you steal this? And, you know, everything else. I mean, I remember, you know, buying my Motorola components from, what was it? In Saddlebrook, there was a company. I was just talking about them the other day. Anyway, the company used to sell surplus commercial and public safety radio equipment. Route 46 in Saddlebrook. I'm just drawing a blank. But anyway, there was one of several places. I had a handy talkie. And people would look at you strange, you have a radio, what's that? Why do you need to talk to people, blah, blah, blah. Okay, let's fast forward to right now. Everybody and his brother carries a cell phone, and everybody has to update their Facebook from their ass, no matter where they are, or Twitter, you know, what, you know, whether they burped, chirped, or ate the black olives, and whether they had pits. I mean, good Lord. I mean, you know, it is kind of amazing how we've come full circle.
A good guy I work with has a daughter, somewhere around 13, 14 years of age, who for the last 6 months has been acting very tired. and he was trying to figure out what's going on. She has a cell phone, maybe she's 15, and he pays for the cell phone that she uses. Since he's the payer of the cell phone bill on a monthly basis, he decided to ask for the carrier to give him a printout of how the cell phone is being used. He was quite horrified to find that she is, on the average day, issuing 800 text messages per day. An awful lot of those text messages are being issued during school time, during class time. He discovered that she has the ability to type into the cell phone to issue a text message while it's in her pocket. And in theory, the teacher doesn't know she's doing it. 800 text messages per day. I think it's close to one every minute and a half that she's awake. And he found out that quite a bit of it's going on in the middle of the night. She wants to stay connected to her friends to that degree. I think every time she hiccups, she's telling her friend about it. You've also heard stories of a kid that'll go to a summer camp, and the summer camp has got some kind of a strict rule that while you're here, you're not allowed to use your cell phone. They take it away from you. And for the first 3 or 4 days, those students, or those campers, go into withdrawal symptoms. They can't be without that thing. It's that degree of addiction. Got to be finding out what your social network of friends are doing. And if you disconnected them for more than half an hour, it seems like you're not alive anymore. Wild. Over to you, KQRIW.
Yeah, there's some extreme sociological issues with that, aren't there? This summer I will take a group of scouts to the interior outpost. We'll end up on either Algonquin or Marcy or wherever up in New York State. And as just a pure matter of course, they will be without their cell phones functionally for 4 days, except for when they're on top of Marcy or on top of Algonquin or some other similar high peak, because guess what? There's just no service there. And the real trick is when they turn on their cell phones. I did this years ago, back in the analog cell phone days, say 12 years ago, I remember turning on a cell phone on top of Mount Marcy and watching my phone spend 15 minutes trying to figure out how to register itself on somebody's network. And when calls were made, 3 out of 4 calls ended up going through a Canadian carrier, and I had to go settle that issue big time.
In those days, I think you had to pay a pretty stiff roaming charge. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So what I didn't want to do is I didn't want to pay the international roaming charge. That's what I was trying to work with. And I basically said, look, you know, the call before and after it were, you know, were carried in the U.S., why was this one all of a sudden magically carried, you know, across the border in Canada? I didn't want to hear that. I was not willing to pay, period. And you know, the high peaks, you know, in the area just to the east of Placid, so it's not like you're right smack on the border. I mean, it's not like you're up in north of Paul Smith's College or something, you know, or up in Malone, New York or something. It was kind of an interesting problem. I want to finish one other story, but I want to throw you this thing before I forget. Go look online for the Khan Academy, K-A-H-N Academy. A lot of good stuff there. A lot of good stuff. And the fellow who runs it and does all the tutorials got started doing this because his niece needed math help, and you know, the uncle was far, far away. So he basically made these little explanatory videos on various, starting with math subjects and moving to other things, like 3,000 other things over time. Has quite a library of free anywhere from 10 to 20 minute tutorials on whatever topic it is that's relevant to what he wants to present. So the Khan Academy is very, very good. Google that one when you get a chance. If you haven't seen it, let me drop it.
Yeah, there is a K-H-A-N Academy, non-profit, created 2006 by Bangladeshi American. Go ahead.
That's the guy. He's marvelous. I mean, really, really good, and I would strongly recommend you check it out. Go to his page, or his website, and there's free tutorials galore. And I use them for all sorts of things. And they're just fun. Another thing I do with grammar school students, just to, show as an exercise, I've done this down to the third grade when they're doing two and three digit multiplication and division. I'll break the, in fact, I told you about this. I basically have them take measurements and I have them use a solid dish. We try to figure out where the focal point is acoustically. And while it's not perfect, it's a great way to show how to do data gathering and how to do experimental techniques and averaging and throw out outliers and all statistical type stuff. But fundamentally, how the formulaic solution versus the experimental measurements come very, very close, and how you can make them closer by throwing out outliers and things like that. It really is a great exercise. You can use the exercise from third graders to college students, because if they're not familiar with the scientific method, it's a beautiful little object lesson. Not to mention it teaches them how the geometry of a parabola works. The last thing I want to tell you, and I want to get from you, what was Ed W2TTM's name, his last name? Because those three characters, I didn't tell you what they ultimately did. They didn't use a 4CX250B pair or an in-push-pull or a 4CX300. They use a 4CN Charlie November 15. That's 1.5. That's a 15-watt dissipation tube. But they made their own anode, heat dissipators, if you will. And it was actually slightly larger than what was on a 4CX300 and a more efficient thermal dispersion characteristic. It's basically the thermal transfer techniques, the design that they built for the ring was just totally different than what was on a 4CX300.
Yeah, W2TTM is Edward J. O'Connor in South Amboy, New Jersey, on Luke Street. He and I hooked up because he was the president of the KGB. KGB is a misspelling, but it stands for Climbing Gigahertz Brethren. So he had a gathering of about 7 or 8 guys in the Amboy area that got on 10 gigs in, I'm guessing roughly 1990. They were way ahead of their time. Over to you, Gordon.
So is Ed still around? And was he part of that Bell Labs pack?
I think he was. He was born in 1920. Last I knew, he did have a bit of a health problem. I haven't heard him on in a significant period of time. But his license is still current. It doesn't expire until 2015. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, Bob Serrato is long gone, and Carl's long gone, but I'm almost convinced, because it was, the third man was Ed. That's all I knew. And when at one point, I'm almost certain I didn't get Carl's amplifier, but it was my understanding that Bob's amplifier, there were 3 amplifiers built, they were all identical, with the exception of the high voltage supply, but they all had the same, control circuitry, they had the same instrumentation panels, they had the same low voltage supplies, and they had the same RF decks. And I had that amplifier until my boys were about, my older boys, well, probably about 20 years ago. When they were coming up on 6 and 4, I think I finally said, I really like to turn this on, but if I turn this on, this thing's going to, you know, one of my kids is going to climb into this rack and I'm going to end up with an electrocuted child, and I'll never forgive myself. So I decided to get rid of the amplifier that I had packaged up and built my own Hi-V supply for and stuff like that back in 77, I guess it was. And but that thing would push, I certainly on CW I was getting out in excess of, you know, 1300 watts. If I could do that key down all day, but I had a lot of air on that thing. I had a huge amount of air on it. Big capacitors and running very high voltage. It was running whatever a 4CN15 could possibly tolerate, and then some. It was just goofy as to how much power I was running on that. Typically on single sideband, I'd run it at, you know, about 800 watts. I'd be dissipating 600, so you could do that all day.
It was idling. If you really cranked that thing up, what do you believe was its peak envelope power capability at maximum HV?
You don't think it was 1300 watts?
Okay. 1300 watts peak envelope power is what you believe. I presume you're talking about on 2 meters?
Say this, on 2 meters, that was CW.
Okay. Key down, CW. And because your power supply doesn't get a chance to fade if you're really transmitting speech, your peak envelope power with speech could be significantly greater than the key down power in CW. It's a function of the stiffness of your high voltage power supply.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what I really didn't want to push it, but you know, 1300 watts on CW is what I would see. In fact, I had 8 5-element quaggies. They started as 4-element quads and they ended up being 5-element quaggies, and I replaced them. 4x2, 4 across, 2 high. Couldn't elevate it, but it made for a really pointy antenna. And I had it in Little Falls, and it was on a rock promontory that rose 60 feet up in all directions. It was the edge of an old quarry lip that was about 30 feet wide, actually. And it was behind my friend's house and up a quarry wall that was his backyard, and he owned the property on top. And so we stuck a section of Rhone 25 into a barrel with large, huge rock, guided out, and then put a long piece of masting on it. Basically built this horizontal mess to hold up the quads or quaggies, and it was interesting. It was fun. Wasn't real practical, and I had trouble. Over time, I had trouble maintaining the accuracy. But with 4 quads across by 2 high, I actually had a little trouble sometimes picking up on people on 2 meters, which I thought was kind of funny because I was using a ham 2 rotator, and just it was too coarse a resolution at times.
I used a ham M rotator on my array of 16 Yagis on 432, 5.5 degree beamwidth, and with skill, you could peek up on a guy by holding down the middle button, which kept the brake released, and then either the right hand or the left hand button, which was clockwise or counterclockwise, you would pulse it with your finger, and therefore you could very slowly steer it onto a person and peek. Were you using that kind of a technique?
Yeah, Yeah, but the problem was sometimes you it would pull off when you dropped the brake in.
Agreed. The Ham-M had a lot finer braking than the Tail Twister. The Tail Twister had a stronger brake, but the notches that the brake would go into were further apart. So your final resolution with the Tail Twister was a lot less. I think that's sort of the problem you're running into. What do you believe was the 3 dB beamwidth of that antenna?
I don't know. Just trying to think. I mean, they weren't terribly long, but they were four across. I'm trying to remember what was it about the spacing that entered into the equation. I'm trying to remember what the spacing was. The spacing was probably only... I'm going to think about this. I think the spacing was only horizontally maybe 10 or 11 feet, probably 11 feet center to center, because the horizontal boom was made out of wood that was cobbled together, and that was a whole other thing. I think I used a center piece of a 2x6, and then with four mast clamps on a 2.5-inch mast or something. 2.5-inch? It would fit in the rotator if it was 2.5, so it must have been 2-inch mast. Do you remember Root Electronics, or pardon me, remember Arrow Electronics? In all their stores, they always had a top section, a tapered top section with of a Rhone 25, with the 9-foot top section sitting on a base plate on the showroom floors in all the Arrow stores.
Sure do remember that, and the one in Farmingdale, Long Island, had just an item, as well as a Rhone 25 tower out in front of the building.
Okay, well, I worked in the store when I was in high school, and then later in college and after. I worked in what was Arrow's store in Totowa, and then later on it became Root Electronics. Joe Shotkin bought that store. He owned Root Electronics on Route 59 up in Nanuet, and then he bought the one in 46 from Arrow and all the inventory and kept all the employees, blah, blah, blah. But the one that was on the floor in the store in Totowa was that top section. It would accommodate a 2-inch mast, and in fact, it would accommodate a 2-inch mast after I cut the top little bit off the collar, because it had this little tapered thing as part of the casting, and I noticed it only went down maybe like an inch. So I said, well, I need a bigger masting than, let's say, the steroidal Radio Shack masting that would go in there normally. So I basically spent forever with a manual hacksaw cutting the top inch off that thing so it slides through a 2-inch mast. I built a shelf for it out of an old aluminum, plate. It was a rack panel plate, but it was a sort of heavy one, because I could deal with aluminum more readily than steel. And I drilled it out for the quarter 20 bolts with my first hand drill, which I only threw out about a year ago. It was a quarter inch chuck Sears drill, which I bought with my own money. It was the first power tool I ever bought. So to answer your question, long story short, is that the wooden boom was that had the four vertical booms on it, they were, I want to say, 11 feet or 10 feet center to center, somewhere in that range, and I don't think they were more than... I don't think they were 10 feet vertical. I think they were shorter. I want to say 9 feet, one above the other. I didn't have 10-foot sections of mast. I had something else. And the reason why they were 5-element quaggies was because, frankly, I didn't have anything that was available. I was recycling materials.
Please, Jersey.
Ahead, Jim.
Gordon, you were groping for the name of the store in Saddlebrook, I think, that sold the Motorolas. Was that Gregory Electronics?
Sure it was. They had a Dick K2RW, W2JC, K2RW on the side, W2DDT.
Yeah. I think in the early days, I believe a lot of people used to buy used taxi cab Motorola equipment as a method of getting on FM. That was in the, let me think now, very early 60s, I think they were in business selling those. And how long did they stay in business, Gordon?
They were in business until about 25 years ago, I figure.
So you believe Ed was the one of those guys that was the AZL group that used to get together, really progressive group. I think CQH, K2CQ, here we go. I can't think of his name all of a sudden. I think he used to join them periodically. When I was talking to Ed on 10 gigahertz, I think it was one night a week, and we did that for about a year, maybe two. One particular night a week, we would talk to each other on 10 gigs for about an hour. And we couldn't figure out, with all the mileage between us and Earth curvature, why was the signal getting there so strong? And one of my speculations was that the Coney Island parachute jump was almost directly in line with the path from his house to my house. So we thought that that may have been a factor. I'm going to have to leave you. Something I got to go do. So back to you, Gordon, for a final. And bye-bye for now. We'll settle all these issues downrange, but when you get a copy of that Epstein book, I think you're going to enjoy it. K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm going to actually take the time to see if I can download the first chapter of the book. A lot of these books are available online. I'm noticing that there might be that opportunity. I'm going to read the first chapter and add that to my, you know, download list. One thing I've gotten good at, instead of buying books and then just not getting around to them, what I do now is I download the first chapter to see if I like it, and then since it's my first chapter list, and then it's kind of like motivation to go buy the book sooner, faster, better. It's really good. Anyway, Dick, you take care. Godspeed. And yeah, I'm pretty sure, Ed, unless it's a different Ed, that's possible. I mean, I do find it odd, though, that in, let's say, 1977 time frame, that Bob Cerrato would be getting rid of somebody else's amplifier if they weren't either moved or dead. And so I'm kind of wondering if it could be anybody else. But anyway, the call sign W2 Tango Tango Mike, as opposed to Tango Tango Tango, my current call, is not lost on me either. Anyway, you take care. It's been fun. Take a look at Khan Academy. You'll have a ball there. And Jim, thanks for popping in too. It's been a pleasure, Dick. And Jim, I'll hang around for a couple minutes more if you want. K2RAWW2JCW2TTT99.
N2DSY.
Yeah, and before that, do you remember what my call was?
No, I don't.
Oh, you B2 Charlie Alpha Mike. Here's the real irony of it. Someone took that as a vanity call.
Hope he enjoys it. Bye-bye.
She will enjoy it, because her husband's a WB2 as well. They got their call signs to be WB2s with their initial. Her name is Carol A. Montgomery, C-A-M. And her husband's something else, I forget what it is. Anyway, WTTT. Good, Jim.
Okay, Gordon. I've been reading the mail for about an hour. Heard bits and pieces on the way home from the monthly meeting, Scotch Plains, and I thought I was listening to the Long Island TechNet for a while there, but took me about 10 minutes for that Gregory to to percolate up to the top after you had groped for it, but figured I'd pop in and say that. Yeah, back in those days, a lot of us spent a lot of time rummaging through Motorola junk.